From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
I feel so weak.
We can't hold out much longer.
Listen, chaps, there's still a chance. I'm done for. I've got a gammy leg and I'm going fast. I'll never get through, but some of you might. You'd better eat me.
Eat you, sir?
Yes, eat me.
Ugh, with a gammy leg?
You didn't eat the leg, Thompson. There's still plenty of good meat. Look at that arm.
It's not just the leg, sir.
What do you mean?
Well, sir, it's just that...
Why don't you want to eat me?
I'd rather eat Johnson, sir.
So would I, sir.
I see.
Oh, well, settle then. Everyone's going to eat me.
Oh, well...
What, sir?
Go ahead, please, but I won't...
Oh, nonsense, sir. You're starving. Duck in.
No, it's not that.
What's the matter with Johnson, sir?
Well, he's not kosher.
That depends how we kill him, sir.
Yes, that's true. But to be perfectly frank, I like my meat a little more lean.
We played that Monty Python sketch for you to set the tone for this discussion about cannibalism. I'm fascinated by this subject, as you'll soon hear, but some of the content you're about to hear is disturbing. So if you're squeamish, you may want to turn down the volume for the first part of our show. Okay, here we go. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Zoologist Bill Shutt has studied cannibalism in animals and humans extensively. He's just published a book called Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. From an evolutionary perspective, why does cannibalism make sense?
Let's see. If you look in the animal kingdom, it makes sense for a number of reasons, and that's pretty much why I decided to write this book. A lot of these examples, generally, people don't know very much about, which made it even more interesting. So there are many creatures where cannibalism is a form of parental care. Examples there would be spiders and snails and other invertebrates that lay what are called trophic eggs. These eggs are never going to hatch. They're infertile eggs. And I think of them as kids' meals. They're doled out to the young as a form of nutrition. That's just one example. There are some really neat ways that rather than feeding your baby milk, for example, there are creatures that are called Sicilians. They are legless amphibians that produce either eggs, so their young either hatch or live young. And the ones that hatch, the babies, were reported to squirm around their mothers after they hatch. Someone took a look at that years later, and they realized that they weren't just squirming around their moms. They were latching onto her skin and peeling her like a grape and eating her. But rather than looking like the epidermis that we're used to looking at, thin, dead skin, this skin was fat-laden and extremely nutritious. So this was an evolved form of parental care in these creatures. And people took a look, some researchers took a look at the species that gave birth to live young, and they found that the babies had a really strange little tooth when they were first born, but that it dropped out soon afterward. And so they wondered what that tooth was used for if it fell out as soon as the babies were born. So they did some dissections on the females, on mothers, on Sicilians. That's with a C for my Italian fans out there and relatives. And what they found was that the oviducts of these individuals in the regions where the babies were developing, where the fetuses were developing, had been eaten away. And so the lining of the oviduct is actually consumed by the developing young. And once again, it was a region that was laden with fat. And so this is another example of an evolved form of parental care. And you know, we could really go on and on. There are other examples kind of like that all across the animal kingdom.
It's so interesting. So in that instance that you're talking about, does the, quote, mother survive?
Yeah, great question, because it is energetically expensive, and she does lose weight, but she grows the skin back really quickly, and then they peel it again and eat it. And this goes on for several weeks until the babies sort of take off by themselves. But there is an energetic cost to it. As the babies are gaining weight, the mother is losing weight, but she generally survives.
Well, nursing human mothers often lose weight while their babies are gaining weight.
Mm-hmm. This is a strange example of parental care.
What is the earliest documentation of human cannibalism?
Oh, well, you've got to be careful. We're fairly certain that ancient humans were cannibals, mostly because of things like cut marks that indicate that flesh was removed from bone. For example, I looked at Neanderthals, and there is an indication that Neanderthals practiced cannibalism, as did their ancestors, Homo antecessor, which may have lived up to half a million years ago in Europe. But you've got to be careful. Just because you find bones with cut marks doesn't necessarily mean that cannibalism has taken place. Let's say, tragically, someone gets killed by a bayonet and they're buried, and 100 years later you dig them up and you see that there's a cut mark on a bone. You can't interpret that as cannibalism. But you can if you find the bones in the same proximity and treated the same way as the bones of game animals. And so there are indications that cannibalism did take place in ancient humans. It would be a surprise to me if it didn't. You know, they didn't have the same taboos that we developed in the West, starting with the Greeks and through the Romans and Shakespeare and Brothers Grimm and Sigmund Freud and everybody in between. We've really been patterned to think that cannibalism is just about the worst thing that you can do. There are other groups of people all over the world that did not get that input. So they have different habits.
So let's talk about that, because I think people would be surprised. So when we think of human cannibalism, we think of things like really extreme situations in which people, if they're going to survive, like the Donner Party,
sure,
they have to turn to eating folks who have died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, survival cannibalism.
Right. But I understand that there's also Epicurean cannibalism.
Yeah. First of all, Epicurean cannibalism may have taken place elsewhere, but the Chinese kept really good records. There were pages and pages of recipes using human flesh to prepare all sorts of interesting sounding dishes, from soups to dumplings, fried, boiled, broiled, just about any way you can think of it.
And were there references to what kinds of humans or parts of humans were the most delicious?
Yeah, well, there were reports, you know, you'd hear this from leaders that went in and they'd take a place over and they would prefer females, they'd prefer young people, they would prefer children. And that sort of makes sense. If you're thinking of this as just as flesh and don't have the ideas that we have, it's kind of nasty business, but the descriptions are there. Evidently, children and females were preferred over eating men.
I mean, it's disturbing, but it's also incredibly fascinating. How recent did this kind of cannibalism happen?
Culinary cannibalism. Probably. We're probably talking about 500-600 years ago. Not a whole lot of it reported as some of the other forms of cannibalism, like medicinal cannibalism throughout China, were reported up until really recently, and then throughout Europe as well. But culinary cannibalism, a different story there. I don't imagine that it took place very recently, at least from the reports.
You know, it's so interesting. Reading your book, I started thinking about the present practice of eating dogs in parts of the world and our horror of it. And I started thinking about how for us, we view our pets as an extension of ourselves.
Sure.
So to us, it's almost like human cannibalism rather than just, you know, an animal that's just another animal.
Absolutely. Culture is king. You know, our culture dictates to us that we don't eat dogs, we don't eat cats. In cultures where that's not taught, you know, that's a food source. I found this to be the case in many instances. There are groups that just don't have the same preconceived notions. When anthropologists and missionaries went into and met the Waré in the Brazilian Amazon, the Waré were just as mortified to learn that the Europeans were burying their dead as the Europeans were to learn that the Waré consumed their dead.
And this consumption was part of a spiritual practice?
Yeah, it was an alternative to burial. It was a funerary rite. So rather than put their loved ones in the cold ground to rot and be consumed by worms, that they incorporated their loved ones into themselves. And so it was to them it was a beautiful act. And they were, you know, in a sense, freaked out that they were being told to bury their dead from then on because cannibalism was a bad thing.
You referred to medicinal cannibalism. What is that?
Medicinal cannibalism would be using human body parts, any number of different types of human body parts, as medicines, as curatives. And probably the biggest surprise that I ran into in writing this book was that it had been so widespread throughout Europe for hundreds of years, starting in the Middle Ages, extending through the Renaissance, and right up into the early part of the 20th century. And to me, this was a surprise because we in the West have this cannibalism taboo that has been ingrained in us since the time of the Greeks. And so the very idea of consuming body parts, like drinking blood, crowds used to form at executions, and they used to collect blood from the condemned, sometimes while they were still alive, to treat epilepsy. Skulls and bones were ground up and used. Fat was used to cure skin ailments. Probably just about every body part you can think of, except maybe the gallbladder, because it's so bitter, the bile that's in it, was used for all sorts of purposes in many European countries for many, many years. This was a complete surprise to me, and at a certain point, they did a really good job of hiding that it ever happened.
It's interesting, because when you think about homeopathy and this idea of like for like, like treats like, I guess that's sort of the extreme extension of that idea.
Yeah, I would say. Once again, I was really surprised by the whole thing. I went into this thinking, well, we've got this cannibalism taboo, so why would people consume body parts for medicinal purposes if you're being taught that cannibalism is the worst taboo that you can break?
What's the distinction between exocannibalism and endocannibalism?
With regards to human cannibalism, exocannibalism is when you are eating humans that are not part of your group, and endocannibalism is when you are eating parts from members of the group that you belong to.
Wow. So exocannibalism would be like some of the top of mind kind of cannibalism we think of, like the Maori tradition or the tradition of certain tribes in Africa when interlopers were taken in and eaten as what? An example? A threat?
Sure. When you get into a fight with a group and you beat them, then you consume their the beaten warriors. It happens in the wild as well. Chimpanzees do this. If they get into a battle with another group, they may kill and consume outsiders.
Wow. What happened during the time of the Greeks that created the taboo?
All I know is that from as far back as I could trace, and I went back and looked at the writings of Homer, I found that I could tell the first mention of cannibalism, and that was the story of Odysseus and Polyphemus, the Cyclops, and how he killed, and sort of cannibalization, when you think of the Cyclops as not quite human, but close enough. And then from there, those types of ideas that cannibalism was the work of monsters, or when you get to Shakespeare, it's the most serious form of vengeance that you could perpetrate on someone. This was just something that grew and grew and grew, and until it snowballed into this taboo that we have now. And, you know, it went through the Brothers Grimm as a way to teach your children that if you're bad, you're going to get eaten. And Sigmund Freud and the early anthropologists, at the end of that line is the cannibalism taboo that we now, well, we think we know quite a bit about. You know, most of it has to do with these horrific types of events, when in reality there are a number of other really interesting functions that cannibalism has, whether you're looking at humans or whether you're looking at across the entire animal kingdom.
Yeah, when you talk about the non-human natural world, you say that in the natural world, strangers eat strangers, parents eat their children eat their parents, and siblings eat each other, and they do it a lot.
It probably happens in some groups far more commonly than in others, like invertebrates, insects, snails, arachnids like spiders and scorpions. A lot of cannibalism takes place. And then you move into the vertebrates, and it's very common in egg-laying fish. Also very common in amphibians. There's a great example that I was able to study, and that's cannibalism that functions as a hedge against unpredictable environmental conditions. I went and visited researchers out in Arizona, and they were working on the spadefoot toad. These toads lay their eggs in very, very shallow, transient ponds that look more like puddles. And with the dry conditions, they could dry up overnight. And so if they do, and you haven't developed into a toadlet yet, if you're not able to hop off, if you're still a tadpole, then you die. And what has evolved is that a large number of these tadpoles, laid in the same brood as their little siblings, they just almost overnight, within 2 or 3 days, they turn into giants with huge mouths and big jaw muscles and big teeth, and they cannibalize their broodmates. And by doing so, they're able to develop quicker and leave the pond to ensure that at least some of that brood survives.
Wow. The earth is a brutal place sometimes.
Yeah. But very interesting, though, isn't it?
Bill Shutt's new book is Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. Okay, enough of that. Now we return to the realm of good foods, starting with a visit to a cheese shop that builds itself as the oldest in America. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
Hello, Angela. I just wanted you to know that the juice is fresh squeezed, the coffee's fresh ground, and I'm the one who got you fired.
What did you say?
I said I'm the one who got you fired. But look at the bright side. You don't have to go back to that office anymore. I could have told you this all in person. But I thought this way would be a lot less painful for both of us.
That's the unforgettable voice of Tony Danza. He played a single dad, retired baseball player, and boyfriend to Angela on the 1980s TV sitcom Who's the Boss? But we're not talking to Tony about acting today. Nope, we called him to talk about cheese. His New York City store, Oliva of Little Italy, bills itself as the oldest cheese store in America. You have no idea how much I love that you bought this store.
No, well, let me explain how I ended up with it. Remember, it's celebrating its 125th anniversary in October. So it really is a piece of American, Italian, New York history. So my friend Cha-Cha, who was my fight manager when I was a kid, my boxing manager, he has a cafe on Mulberry Street, and he was clocking the store. Bobby Oliva, the namesake, one of the family members of this long tradition from 1892, he just kept hounding him about selling it to him. And finally, I guess the guy ran out of kids, and so he sold it to us. And I was just a silent partner. And then, unfortunately, my friend got sick and he passed away, Cha-Cha, the great Cha-Cha. And so I'm, you know, now involved more, you know, strategically involved in the store. I used to just eat there. Now I have to actually do something.
I imagine that you never expected it to turn out this way.
No, and I'll be honest with you, aside from losing one of my dearest friends, which is so hard, he was just one of the greatest guys of all time. And we went through so much together. Aside from that, I was really like, oh, God, just what I need. I don't need a stud. I need a store like a hole in it. I love it so much. Like, I just left there. I was sitting in the front. You know, we have five benches outside along with a cannoli stand and a gelato stand. And it's a beautiful day today in New York. And I was just sitting on the bench out there talking to people all day. We have people that are residents of the neighborhood, the old ladies and the old men that have been there for years. And there's so many tourists from all over the world that come to that spot. And so it is really one of the great, aside from being a great store, it's one of the great people-watching spots in the world. So I go there, make sure everything tastes good, and then I sit outside and watch the world go by.
Could be worse.
Could be worse, yeah. No, it's wonderful. And I'll be honest, like I said, at first I was really, oh, God, I don't need this. And now I just love it so much. I really do feel a certain responsibility, almost like a curator, more than a store owner, that this is something that you have to not only take care of, but you got to keep it there because, you know, New York is, and L.A. is, I was out in L.A. just working for a couple of months, and I see the same thing. I made this up. It's called neighborhood wasting disease, where the great institutions, the mom-and-pop stores, the cafes, the stores that have been there for 20 and 30 and 40 years are all disappearing because of rent hikes. So we're really determined to not only keep Oliva there, but turn it into the national heritage brand that it deserves to be.
Yeah, because so much of Little Italy has gone by the wayside, and once this leaves, it would just be horrible.
Oh, yeah, we can't. Ferraro's across the street and us and DiPaolo's on the corner. There's some Ernie's store. There's still some authentic stores left, but as you say, it's shrinking and it's threatened. It's progress, I guess. I hate to call it that, but that's what I guess it is.
So let's talk about the sort of marquee product. I mean, at least it's it's what I think of. When I think of Oliva, I think of hand-pulled mozzarella and ricotta. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Well, we make the mozzarella every morning. I'm not kidding. You have to see the machine. It's over 100 years old that stretches the cheese. And it's made the same way we've been making it they've been making it there for over 100 years. And it is really delicious. And our regatta, I have to tell you, and I tell people this all the time, you know, I got hooked on Tate's cookies. I love these cookies. I love double chocolate chip with my regatta. Cookies and regatta. This is how good the regatta is. It belongs on cookies. Forget about it in lasagna. It's unbelievable. But it is so good. It's on, it works on cookies. So.
It's like a shortcut cannoli.
Oh, it's so delicious. I mean, and you know, we make cannoli cream there. We do all that stuff. But the ricotta is just, and I've been eating, you know, I'm Italian, I'm, you know, tutti italiani. So I've been eating ricotta and mozzarella my whole life. And when I tell you, it is very special, ricotta and mozzarella. I'm really proud of it. And we're in the process of getting involved with a big distributor, and hopefully it'll be in all the stores.
Will your face be on the label?
Well, I don't know if my face will be on the label, but certainly I am in front of this. You know, this is another thing that sort of overwhelmed me. You know, at first it was like, you know, I have this store and I want to talk about the store. But people want to, now it's like every place I go, people say to me, hey, I hear you got a store. And I'm like, I did Harry Connick's show. And the first thing he asked me about was the store. Forget about acting. I hear you got a cheese store. So it's become a real big part of my life, and I love it. I really do. And by the way, just to give you an example of how crazy it's become, you know, I used to do a lot of cooking. I love to cook. My father did all the cooking, and I watched him. And I consider myself a pretty good cook, and I get a kick out of doing it. But not any longer, because I have a great chef at the store. Our manager, Danny Pellucci, had a restaurant on Mulberry Street for 90 years, and he's cooking at the place. So basically, I go there, and I stock up the greatest sandwiches in the world, the greatest chicken. Today, we fried chicken cutlets. Forget it, I got a bunch of fresh ones. So it's become like my brother called me the other day. He said, what are you doing? I said, I got to go down to the store. I need vinegar. So, you know, when you're going all the way downtown for vinegar, you know you love the place.
Do your employees still smoke the cheese, smoke the mozzarella?
Yes, we do. We have a 100-year-old smoker in there that sometimes smokes up the whole store. So we have to open all the doors. But yes, we're still smoking. Yeah, we still do it the original way. You know, I was just doing this show in L.A. I was out in L.A. doing a show called There's Johnny, a show about the staff of The Tonight Show when Johnny Carson was the host. And I'm playing the executive producer, Freddie DeCordova, of a certain demographic you might remember. But I had a bunch sent out. I had some smoked mozzarella and some cheese and some dried sausage and all sorts of peppers and stuff sent out to the set. And they went crazy, and especially over the smoked mozzarella. It was like you had there were people fighting over it. It was bizarre. It made me feel pretty good.
So I have to ask you, since you revealed that you cooked for years before you had the store, what's your specialty? What's the Tony Danza special dish?
You know, I like to cook a lot of Italian food, obviously. But you know what I really enjoy? I enjoy going to the market. And the market I go to is around the corner on 60-60, they got a butcher in the market. And so you look and see, what do you want to make tonight? Say, what's for dinner? And you look around and you decide, oh, I'll try this or I'll try that. I'm willing to try things. Now, my specialties are my, you know, my meatballs, my lasagna, you know, Italian dishes. But I like to branch out. And I'm a, you know, I make a great brisket. Forget it. I'll kill you with brisket.
Now, I understand that you actually wrote a cookbook with your son, Mark,
mm-hmm.
called
yes.
Don't Fill Up on the Antipasto, which I have to say, I love that sentence because I've heard it many times.
You know where that comes from, though, right?
Of course.
You know what that's from?
Well, I want to know what your story about.
All right. So the Italians of my family's generations that came here, like in the turn of the century, 1917, I think my grandfather first came here. And my mother's family all together came back in 1929 because they went back to Italy because of the pandemic. They lost a couple of kids in the pandemic, the influenza pandemic. And then they came back to New York and ended up in Brooklyn. And that group of Italian immigrants were very, very, very determined to assimilate. My father used to say, you got to get on the team, you know. He'd say, e pluribus unum, we're all in this together, pal, you know. It was a really, you know, and he fought in the war and he was a real patriot. And they really wanted to be Americans. That was the thing. But they didn't want to give up everything, right? Their whole culture, especially when it came to food. So that would manifest itself on Thanksgiving, because on Thanksgiving you would have an antipasto, which it was everybody's favorite, which would be, you know, cheeses and olives and cold cuts and peppers and with a little oil and vinegar and bread, you know. And then you'd have the lasagna, and maybe there'd be some extra meat or some salad. And then, as a peon to America, you'd have a whole American Thanksgiving dinner, turkey, all the trimmings. And what they would tell you is, because there was so much eating involved in that, was as soon as you got there, as soon as you walked in the room, they would say to you, don't fill up on the antipasto because you got to eat the rest of this stuff, you know. And so my son and I, my son was born when I was 19. When you have a son that young, when you're that young, it can mess up both of your lives, your son's life and yours. But luckily it didn't. And when it doesn't, it's a great thing to happen because your offspring, your son, my son, met all my relatives. He knew all my crazy uncles and aunts. He knew his great-grandmother. He knew my grandmother. And so he grew up with all these people. Like my daughters, who are in their 20s, they don't even know my parents, hardly. So he knew it all. And so we sat down together, and we put together like 50 recipes, and we tied them to each one of our relatives. So it's Uncle John's clams and Uncle Vinny's lobster, Fra Diavolo. And we told stories about the uncles and aunts. And it was what was so funny about it was he told some stories that I didn't even know. And so it's sort of a memoir cookbook is what it is. And you can get it at my store because we stock them down at Oliva.
So I have to ask you, you live in New York City, a city that's become famously expensive. There are tons of foodies, people who are willing to fork out hundreds of dollars for a single meal. What do you think about all that?
I worry. You know, it concerns me. It's also part and parcel with that neighborhood wasting disease, you know, and it's happening not only in Manhattan, it's happening in the outer boroughs as well, where you're setting up just a playground for the rich. You know, one of the things you notice is if you take the one, you take the subway, I'm on the subway all the time, you take the one, you get off at 14th Street or you get off at 66th Street, you see the same stores. Duane Reade, Chase Manhattan Bank, you know, on Columbus Avenue on the west side from like 67th Street to 72nd Street. All the great cafes are, most of them are gone. We got a lot of those boutiques that nobody goes in and banks. It's frustrating because it speaks to the inequality in our society. And it's just a shame that New York, one of the great melting pots, boiling pots of civilization, is going to be limited by the costs. Across the street from my apartment, there was a terrific cafe. I'm just heartbroken about it, called Nick and Tony's. They have one out in the Hamptons. But it was a little cafe on 67th Street. And after 23 years, they closed their doors a couple of months ago. And in fact, on the corner in that same building, there was a Starbucks. Now, Emma, could you imagine Starbucks can't pay the rent? That's how crazy it's getting. So
that's kind of scary.
Yeah, it's really frightening.
I have to ask you, on the off night when you haven't brought in merchandise from the store to eat, where do you like to go out?
Off night is very rare. I love Patsy's on 56th Street. You know, it's been there. Frank Sinatra used to hang out there. Sal Scognamillo, good friends of mine. Where else do I go? I go downtown a lot, too. I eat at Lamella. I eat at Angelo's. You know, I try to spread it around a little bit. But I'm telling you, it's really, really difficult because it's hard to beat our food. We got 5 months now until the next feast, the St. Gennaro feast. And we just did it, it seems like. You know, we did it in September of this year. And I just had a guy come up to me today as I was sitting outside in front of the store. He says, hey, you know, I was here for the feast. And I said, oh, yeah, how you doing? He says, we took a picture together. I said, okay. I said, that was you, you know. And then he says, I just want you to know, that was not feast food. He says, you guys had some great food. He said, the brajol, he said, the broccoli rabe. He said he had a stuffed artichoke. He says, that's not feast food. And I'm telling you, I have one of the great Italian chefs, our rice balls, our prosciutto balls, our mozzarella sticks, our, you know, everything in the store is just such high quality. And it's so thrilling to hear people say, wow, this is unbelievable. Or those guys are sandwich artists behind your counter, you know. I'm proud of it. I'm really proud of it. And we're really trying mightily to make it all it should be. It's white tile. It looks like something out of like if you were going to build a model of a little Italian store. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, to me it looks like my favorite stores in Rome and Naples from the 30s.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. And come to Oliva.
We'll
give you the discount. We'll give you the discount. You get the I interviewed him discount.
I'm happy to pay full price if it helps you stay.
Oh, that's very nice. But yeah, I'm telling you, come down. There's some mozzarella in your future.
Sounds good to me.
All right, love.
Tony Danza is one of the owners of Oliva of Little Italy. The store celebrates its 125th anniversary this year. In a minute, we return to our own neck of the woods, to a store with 500 different kinds of cheese. That's when this show continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Hear that? It's Norbert Wadnig serenading us from the Cheese Store of Beverly Hills. The shop has more than 500 different kinds of cheese for the tasting, along with a huge selection of condiments, salumi, and bread. The store celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Hi, Norbert.
Hi.
50 years old.
50 years old, yes.
That's venerable in Southern California.
I think that's a landmark, actually. Certainly in Beverly Hills. Other than Nate and Al's, I don't think there's another place in the area.
That's an institution.
Right.
You have not been here for the entire 50 years, so tell us a bit about your story, and did it have anything to do with the piano?
It did. It's a little bit of a sad story. Many people come out to California, right, to either become an actor or a musician. I wanted to become a musician, right? Growing up in New Orleans, being born in Vienna, being around food, music, and alcohol. You know, you got to come out here. The Beatles, right? Let's come to the coast. We're going to make it big. And guess what?
You got a job in a cheese store.
That's right, because I went broke almost immediately. You know, one of those stories, I was this close to making it. You know, one of those rare stories. Hardly ever hear it.
And what was the hourly wage when you first...
It was $1.80 an hour. And now, 40 years later, it's $2.80 an hour.
It's not high enough for that amount of time. We haven't had enough appreciation. When I think about when you and I first started talking about cheeses 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
so much has changed since then. Just access, availability. Plus,
absolutely.
Plus, it seems like the cheese scene itself, particularly nationally, completely changed.
Right.
Give us a sort of a bird's eye view of what the store looked like when you started here compared to now.
It was somehow an upscale Hickory Farms. That said, it was innovative, even back then. Like the music scene and the food scene, it's truly, truly evolved. Especially here in California.
So for people who don't remember...
Hickory Farms.
Hickory Farms. You're talking about meat sticks.
Meat sticks, processed cheeses.
Cheese balls.
Smoked, yeah, all of that. All of that.
And now, give me an estimate of how many cheeses you have right now in the shop.
You know, it varies during the course of the year. But anywhere from 400 to 600 different cheeses from all over the world. France, Italy, Spain, Germany, Austria, the Netherlands, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, as well as a flourishing number of American artisanal cheeses.
Compared to 20 years ago, let's say,
mm-hmm.
are customers more knowledgeable? Are they more adventurous?
Absolutely. Especially here in Beverly Hills, people travel a great deal. They're affluent. They have certain expectations, and we have to meet those. And it's fun. You want to look for that new cheese. You want to look for that new gourmet item, that special wine, all of that.
Because we should say, walking into the store, yes, there are the cheeses. But for me, I have to say, the thing that sidetracks me is the condiment wall.
Yeah, it's pretty expansive.
And condiments are a fairly new thing. It used to be if you were a chef and you needed to find some saba, for example, mm-hmm. from Italy, you had to poke around a lot.
Right. And we had to have it. It had to be there. I have to say, you know, I'm a little bit old-fashioned in this. And if a cheese is really good, I tend to tend to stay away a little bit from the condiments, though I appreciate the fact that chefs have made wonderful use of them and made exciting recipes. I'm an old cheese merchant.
So let's talk about cheese. In this arc, since you've been here, what have been the overarching sort of trends? Maybe we should start now and go back. You can start back and go forward. For example, I remember when all of a sudden there were Basque cheeses that nobody heard of.
Right. And goat cheeses and blue cheeses. We probably have like 40 different blue cheeses now, whereas in the beginning we had two or three. You know, there was a Roquefort, there was a Gorgonzola, and there was one American Maytag Blue. That was it. Now there are 40 different ones from all over, from all different countries. Virtually every country that makes a cheese makes a blue cheese. So we try to bring all of that in.
Whenever people are thinking about real super artisanal cheeses, or I guess the kind of all the cheeses that you have would fall under that. But raw milk cheeses, for people who have had the opportunity of tasting them, are often very prized. What's the situation here? Are you allowed to carry them?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the misnomers. Anything aged over 60 days can legally be brought into the country. So many of the cheeses that you've been eating anyway have been raw milk. It's the ones that are aged less than 60 days that are,
verboten,
let's just say, difficult to get.
These days, when you can find a selection of cheese at Whole Foods, other high-end markets, and Costco even, what you're not getting in any of those places is the hand sell. I mean, someone who's going to take you along on a journey.
Right. Let me give you a good example of that. Everybody knows Jarlsberg, right? Well, what we do with a wheel of Jarlsberg, a really underestimated, overlooked cheese at this point, that was really popular when I first started. Think about it. If you hold on to it and those little holes begin to expand, the gases expand, this becomes a really good cheese. You don't cut it as soon as, you know, it comes into the supermarket and wrap it. We let it really puff up and you cut into it, it has, I mean, it has a lot of flavor. And that's the difference between buying it in the supermarket and buying it at a local cheese store.
So when you make that first cut, it's like the cheese exhales.
Right. And, you know, we all gather around and we all take the first slice.
I bet it's really sweet and nutty.
It's sweet, it's nutty, it's delicious. You're really doing yourself an injustice if you're buying it in a supermarket.
Do you decide, because it's such a plethora, and I'm sure sometimes people walk in and they're just paralyzed by the choice. So do you make a decision, or the other cheesemongers who work with you make a decision, okay, this week we're going to concentrate on X?
No, not so much. I mean, what we try to do is literally cater to the individual that comes in. First of all, the atmosphere is very relaxed. I mean, we are probably the least pretentious store in all of LA, let alone Beverly Hills. And what we do is ask the person what they normally like, and then sort of adventure out from there. It should be an experience more than just a shopping event.
Let's say I'm standing there at the cheese case.
Okay.
And I should say I'm not. I'm in this incredible cove, where there's a wonderful upright piano with beautiful wood inlay, and there's a long oak table that must host hundreds of tastings. And then on the walls all around us are just bottles of wine. But let's pretend at the cheese case. And I say to you, my palate is a bit fatigued by the really high note cheeses, the high acid, the super flavor bombs. I want to have something that's really buttery and smooth and creamy, not necessarily in texture, but in mouthfeel and flavor.
Well, I would go to one of the Basque cheeses first. Something like a Torquay is very smooth. And sheep's milk, despite what people think, if they've never had it before, is a very rich, delicious cheese. I mean, it's a wonderful milk. And those cheeses tend to give off exactly what you were describing, a very rich, creamy, delicate, fulfilling taste.
Okay, so now I have my nice, rich, creamy cheese.
Mm-hmm.
I want something goaty.
Yeah.
But maybe something with a little age on it, not really soft, not so much a fresh cheese.
Mm-hmm. Maybe something like betmal.
Ooh, I've never
betmal
heard of that.
Is
what's
a Basque sheep's milk cheese, a goat's milk cheese, that has a lot of flavor but is not challenging. You know, goat tends to have, just by nature, a pretty good little bite to it. This is a good starting spot for people that have never had goat cheese, for example.
Do you also carry, for example, various kinds of prosciutto or salumeria?
Oh, absolutely. If you've never had it, the jamón ibérico and the ibérico de bellota, if you've had prosciutto before, this is a real step up. These are the animals that are fed on acorns, and it's a tight, rich, absolutely delicious meat, which is one of my favorites. And there are also pâtés and all sorts of salamis. Especially, there is an ibérico salami, chorizo, which is not like the Mexican chorizo. This is one you just slice and eat as it is, but made from the ibérico pig, which makes it
wow
very special.
Very rich. Are there public tastings?
We do have, you know, public tastings that we do in the back of Sharky's.
That's hilarious. You do it in the back of Sharky's?
Sharky's, yeah. And you probably remember the restaurant, what was it called, Rustica.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful restaurant, and then it went through a number of different changes. But they still have this beautiful back patio with a roof that opens up. There's a little waterfall in there and a fountain. And at any rate, we rent that, and we go up to 74 people. We taste 10 different cheeses, 8 different wines, and then we have a little meal, and we invite different chefs under the strict supervision of Eric Kelly to make something special. That's, you know, what we do is we pick an area, and from that area we take the cheeses and the wines and try to do something that would be indicative of that area in the recipe.
That's nice. So it's like an in-depth geographic tasting.
Exactly.
And who is Eric Kelly?
He is head of catering here at the store.
Which you must do a lot of.
He does quite a bit, yeah.
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 And the platters.
Platters, yes.
Yeah.
I think we do some very, very nice platters, you know, especially concentrating on hard-to-find and adventurous cheeses, as we said before.
Like what?
For example, there's Moliterno, a sheep's milk cheese from Sardinia that's infused with truffles. There's another cheese called Alpenblumen, which is from Austria, where I come from, that actually has the local flowers dried and pressed into it.
So is that like Heidi cheese?
Kind of like Heidi, you know, you cut into it and the sound of music comes on.
And you have a brooch in
yeah,
with
no,
it.
Opa, opa, pa. Yeah. It's cheeses like that. And some of the rare goat cheeses that we get, soft ripening cheeses, a little of everything, you know.
You're very trim. How do you moderate your cheese consumption?
I don't. And that's the key. I don't know. And I should mention, I love bread. I love bread. Colleen DeLay, who you may know, who makes bread for us and Curtis Stone and for Ludo, was a customer of ours, and we talked her into, you know, going out. Let's make some of this bread to sell. And she did, and she's become very successful.
Yeah, her baguettes are notable.
Right. Dominic, who works here, makes some great sun-dried tomatoes, sun-dried tomato pestos. Everybody has their own little niche. Tony makes wine.
It's like a family.
Yeah. We fight, we laugh, we kick, we scratch, we bite, you know, the whole thing.
If someone were to come in the store today and say, give me something really unusual that is new to you or new-ish to you that you're really excited about, what would that cheese be?
It would be twofold. One would be that Alpenblumen, which is here for the first time. And another one is a cheese, again, that's been around for quite a while, but it's just tasting so good. It's called Saint-Albret. And Saint-Albret is a semi-washed rind cheese, and it's in kind of a flower shape. I loved it when I first started here, so much so that the dog that wandered in off the street that we adopted, I named him Albret. I've just come back to it in the last 2 weeks, and it is absolutely delicious when it's fresh and young.
Is it cow's milk?
Cow's milk.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Norbert Wapnig is the owner of the Cheese Store of Beverly Hills.
Good morning. Morning, sir. Welcome to the National Cheese Emporium.
Ah, thank you, my good man.
What can I do for you,
sir? Well, I was sitting in the public library in Thurman Street just now, skimming through Rogue Harry's by Hugh Walpole, and I suddenly came over all peckish.
Peckish, sir?
Esurient.
Eh?
Yeah,
well, hungry
like.
Ah, hungry.
Yeah, not sure. And I thought to myself, a little fermented curd would do the trick. So I curtailed my wall polling activities, sallied forth and infiltrated your place of purveyance to negotiate the vending of some cheesy comestibles.
Come again?
I want to buy some cheese.
Oh, I thought you were complaining about the bouzouki player.
Oh, heaven forbid, I am one who lights in all manifestations of the perpsicity of muse.
Sorry?
Hungry yet? We stop by a deli that's serving up some very tasty Scandinavian fare. Don't turn that dial. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. When you think of a deli, do you picture gravlax, lingonberry jam, and Swedish meatball sandwiches on the shelves? That's just what you'll find at Olsen's Scandinavian Delicatessen on Pico Boulevard. The owner is Christian Needler. Full disclosure, Needler used to work for me at Angeli many, many years ago. Currently, he's the maitre d' at the iconic LA restaurant Dantana's. Tell us about Olsen's. I'm lucky it's in my neighborhood.
I always went there to get my Scandinavian fix, so to speak, because they had all the stuff from home that you miss when you grow up somewhere.
And this is before IKEA came on the
scene. Oh, yeah. I got here in 84.
So what were some of the foods that you would buy?
Definitely the cod roe in a tube. That's a classic. The Christmas or Easter soda.
What are Christmas and Easter sodas?
Well, it's the same soda. They just put a different label on it. But it's like an adult soda, I'd like to call it, because it kind of reminds me of a little bit of there's a Pellegrino Chinotto. It kind of reminds me of that, but it's usually traditionally for Christmas and Easter.
So it's a little bitter.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it's kind of like an Averna, but non-alcoholic.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Who were the Olsens? And did they own it until you came along?
Well, there was the first Olsen, who started in 1948, and then I think he sold it like 10 years later, somewhere around there. And then another person named Bertil Olsen, which is pretty funny. I mean, it's a common name in Sweden. I think my brother worked at a place in Stockholm that was called Olsen's. So it's a lot of Olsen's. And then he had it since I took over about 3.5 years ago.
Wow. And we're so happy you did, because one could tell towards the end there that it was going to go away.
Yeah, they were trying to sell it, and nobody was biting. And then I always wanted to do something. I think I wanted to more be a bar restaurant with Scandinavian influences. But then this came along, and I said, okay. So
for me, it has something about it that is very 40s. When I
right.
walk in there, it feels like all the cookbooks I was fascinated by when I was a teenager, where I would open up and look at those pictures, and it was like time travel.
Yeah. Well, Art Deco is my favorite time period, I would say, as far as architecture and so on, interiors.
Is it just a deli, or is there also seating where people could sit down and eat?
There's a cafe side. I kind of split it up into two, and there's one side is cafe side and one's the deli side. I mean, I'd like to eventually develop it some more and maybe even more restaurant-oriented, but right now it's more sandwiches and salads and smaller plates.
So what are some of the most popular?
Well, the most popular, I'd say, is the shrimp sandwich, which is like a lobster roll, but it's called Greenland shrimp, which is the same or very similar to the one you get outside of Norway, the coast of Norway.
Is it a salad with like a sauce like mayonnaise and dill?
Yes, a little bit of mayonnaise, creme fraiche, dill, shallots, lemon, and probably something secret.
It's really delicious.
Thank you. And then the gravlax is, I'd say, the second most popular dish. Then there's the meatball sandwich.
So the meatball sandwich, I would imagine this isn't a meatball sandwich covered with tomato sauce and Parmesan.
No, it's like fried onions and beets.
And you make your own Swedish meatballs mm-hmm. in-house.
Yes, we do.
And I have to say the egg salad's pretty great, too.
I know. I had a customer at Dantana's who came by. He said, you know, that egg salad, it's the best egg salad I ever had. That should be your item. That should be your thing. So I don't know. We'll see.
But then there's this whole other part of Scandinavia, which is all the sweet stuff. Like there's the candy, the salty licorice.
Yes, the salty licorice. It's very addictive if you grew up with it.
Oh, I'm totally into it.
I can't eat candy anymore, so.
Yeah, I actually had a bag of it by my bedside for the last 3 nights. I finally had to hide it from myself.
Yeah, I do, and I'm cutting it off. But it's great, though. I mean, it's not as sweet as American candy, so. And there's, you know, no GMOs, that kind of thing. So it's and made with real sugar. I love it. The salty licorice is it's an acquired taste. I love giving it to Americans and see how they react. Like 1 out of 100 like it.
I used to think when I would go into Olsen's that almost the only people that would go there were Scandinavians who were looking for something very specific. And so they were willing to travel across LA. But now I get a sense that there's many more people coming in from the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's what I've been trying to do because, I mean, the busiest time of the year is right around Christmas and month before because of the Scandinavians, because Christmas is huge. But I've been trying to develop more for the Americans. It's more for them in a way.
But I think we tend to think first about the giant flavor bomb. We go for the super spicy.
Right.
So going out and saying, yeah, I'm going to go experience this Nordic cuisine is different, but it's so good.
Yeah, it's not super spicy. They're not known for their spice exactly. Yeah,
it's comforting.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's... I mean, it's different flavors. It's very interesting because somebody did a magazine article about Sweden and Japan, how similar it is in many ways, the food, design, etc. It is very similar in that way.
Yes, stripped down, simple.
Yeah.
And fish.
Fish.
Without a lot of elaboration.
Yeah. Fish, and more fish. And any fish product.
Only with you, it's potatoes.
Oh, yeah, potatoes.
Not rice.
Yeah, no rice.
Christian Needler owns Olsen's Scandinavian Delicatessen on Pico Boulevard in Mid-City. Let's close out the show with a review from Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic Jonathan Gold. Jonathan, where are we going today?
The Kobe Factory, or the Kibbe Factory, or the Kobe Factory, however one wishes to pronounce it, which is a wonderful Syrian restaurant.
So describe what the marquee name is, the marquee dish.
Kibbe, which is like Lebanese kibbe, I guess, is ground lamb mixed with seasonings and with bulgur wheat.
They kind of look like little footballs?
They look like little footballs. And sometimes when you walk in late afternoon, there'll be a table of women sitting around a giant bowl of stuff, making them, forming them into the shapes. And then I don't even know how they form the skin around it.
There's the one layer of the outside, the casing. And then there's the inside, which is a different filling.
It's a different filling. And the outside is sort of dense and becomes very crispy and delicious when it's fried.
So good.
And they do a kind of kibbe there that I think, or they say, is particular to Syria, which is the grilled kibbe or barbecued kibbe, in which it's forming less into a football and more into a sort of puck-like shape.
Tell me about the sides.
You basically get a choice between cucumbers in yogurt, which is delicious, or a green salad, which is a green salad. It comes with a side of hummus, and their hummus is lovely. It's silky almost. It has a really nice, smooth texture.
What else did you get?
The majadra is the best I've ever had there.
It's one of my favorite dishes ever. Describe what it is.
Usually you get it, and it will be lentils fried with rice. They do it, it's lentils fried with bulgur wheat. And it has this lovely sort of golden color, and it has a nice texture, and it just tastes like something that's been gently fried. On top, as with all good versions of the dish, there are onions that have been cooked down and then frizzled. So all of the onion flavor concentrates. They're crunchy. They're golden brown. They look as if they've been burnt, but they have not been burnt even a little bit. And it adds so much flavor to the dish.
Given that they seem to be embracing the bulgur, do they have a tabbouleh that's really good too?
They have a tabbouleh, and I'm not sure I'd put it in my top 10 tabbouleh of all time.
I love that there would be a top 10 tabbouleh list.
Well, I mean, I've eaten a lot of tabbouleh in a lot of places in a lot of cities. There's nothing wrong with their tabbouleh. It's a perfectly good, serviceable tabbouleh. Their falafel is also, it's a delicious falafel, but I probably wouldn't go there just for that or even for the shawarma plate, though the shawarma plate is delicious.
It's all about the kibbeh.
It's all about the kibbeh. They do one thing that I've never seen anybody else do, which is they call it stuffed intestines. It's like lamb intestines, which are, you know, small. They're like thumb thick, stuffed with a mixture of rice and lamb and minced vegetables and spices, and then, you know, cooked in a soup. So it's a sausage, but because there's this method where they press all the air out of the intestines with their fingers. And by intestines, let's just say sausage cases. Let's not talk about intestines anymore. Because they press all the air out, it looks very intestinal. But you eat it, and it's like the most delicious rice sausage. It's so good. It comes in a broth, is gently flavored with cinnamon.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah. If you could eat it with your eyes closed, you would be happy as a clam.
Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is dining at Kobe Restaurant and Syrian Kitchen this week in Van Nuys. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations.
Gouda?
Nope.
Edam?
Nope.
Caithness?
Nope.
Smith Austrian?
Nope.
Japanese Sage Derby?
Nope.
You do have some cheese.
That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website, on KCRW's mobile app, or any other app that delivers podcasts to your phone. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. They are
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine. Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
Ronnie Mickelson,
and not forgetting Phil Richards. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.
Not much. It's the single most popular cheese in the world. Around here, sir.